You are listening to Hit Play, Not Pause, a feisty menopause podcast for active, performance-minded women. I am your host, Celine Yeager. Each week, I bring you advice from athletes, scientists, researchers, and other experts to help you feel and perform your best, no matter what your hormones are doing. This show is a production of Live Feisty Media. Hello, strong, feisty women. I have a super fun and thought-provoking one for you this week as I welcome back Dr. Lauren Stryker, the author of the upcoming book, Put the O Back in Mojo, a guide to postmenopause libido and orgasm. We actually have a bit of a two-part conversation here this week because Lauren is also the author of a provocative editorial in a recent edition of the journal Menopause that was titled, Is It Time to Rethink How Menopause is Defined? And in that editorial, she brings up a lot of issues that I have wondered about over the past few years and that I hear women wrestling with every day. Like, how do I know if I'm in menopause if I don't get periods because of surgery or ablation or IUD use or birth control pills, you name it? How do you know where you are in the perimenopausal process with all of that? She makes a really good argument that the definition is outdated, and for research sake alone, if nothing else, we really need to rethink it. So I really enjoyed that part of the conversation, and then we just kind of take a hard pivot, and we get into her new book on orgasm in postmenopause, which is important and terribly overlooked. Because as her recent survey that she did in conjunction with Cosmo shows, women in postmenopause, shock, 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 are still interested in having sex and orgasms. Lauren brings a wealth of knowledge and experience to the table. She is also the author of Sex RX, Hormones, Health, and Your Best Sex Ever, and is one of the top authorities on the topic of menopause and sexual health. She does hilarious presentations at the Menopause Society meetings. She should be stand-up. Anyway, she is also a clinical professor of obstetrics and gynecology at Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine, and she is the founding medical director of the Northwestern Medicine Center for Sexual Medicine and Menopause. Lauren has been featured on Oprah and Good Morning America, Nightline 2020, and Today, just to name a few. She also has her own podcast that I'll put a link to in the show notes called Dr. Stryker's Inside Information. Lauren is always a huge delight to talk to. I hope you enjoy this one as much as I did. All right, before we get to it, as always, give us a follow on Feisty Menopause on Instagram and Facebook. Come join our private Hit Play Not Pause Facebook group. And listen up, if you haven't yet, sign up for my brand new newsletter. It's a fun one, not too long, not too short. Just enough new info to keep you entertained and in the know. I cover the latest research, highlight badass women doing cool things, muse a little bit on what's on my mind, all kinds of great stuff. Check it out. I'll put a link in the show notes to make it a snap. All right, enough of me. Let's have a few words from our sponsors and get on with the show. Good sleep. The one thing that sets you up for a great workout and a good day is quality sleep. We talk about it all the time here on the show, which is why I'm stoked to have Lagoon Sleep as a new sponsor. Because one of the most overlooked tools in a great sleep toolbox is the thing you literally rest your head on 8 hours a night, your pillow. A quality pillow is everything. Otherwise, you end up tossing, turning, punching, and folding your pillow, waking up with neck pain, and all the stuff that happens when your pillow doesn't meet your personal comfort needs. Say hello to the most comfortable sleep you've ever had with Lagoon. They start you out with a 2-minute personalized pillow quiz and then pair you with your perfect pillow. I got the Otter, a cooling adjustable pillow that is perfect for side sleepers who run warm at night like I do. It is a dream. It's fully adjustable, so I was able to get the perfect loft and support, and the cooling feature is everything. As someone who turned into a furnace every evening before menopause, I appreciate that the Otter is stuffed with shredded gel-infused memory foam, which instead of trapping heat from my neck and head, draws it away and dissipates it. It's truly delightful. I'm a good sleeper, and Otter has taken it to the next level with both support and cooling. Put my head down, good night, Irene. My Oura Ring confirms what little tossing and turning I was doing is gone. The beauty of the pillow quiz is you can get the perfect pillow that you need to and make your sleep the best sleep you can have. Go to lagoonsleep.com/hitplay and take the 2-minute quiz to find your perfect match, and then use the code HITPLAY, all caps, one word, for 15% off your first purchase. Sweet dreams. Okay, Lauren, Dr. Stryker, I am so glad to have you back again, and we have a lot to talk about. So welcome back.
I am so glad to be back here talking with you.
So let's start with the editorial that caught my eye you did in Menopause, titled, Is It Time to Rethink How Menopause is Defined? And, you know, this has crossed my mind a couple of times, but not anywhere. Like, you really dug into it on so many levels, and I thought, She's got a lot of points. So what inspired you to write that?
So this is how it came about. I am on the editorial committee for the journal Menopause. And what the editorial committee does is we're the ones that review these studies and articles that come through the door to see if they are worthy. And quite frankly, over 90% of them are just rejected. It is not easy to get your study or your article in a top line journal like Menopause. So I was asked to review an article from someone who was looking at the frequency of hot flashes in countries around the world. So I thought, okay, so I'm, you know, reading through this and plowing through the numbers, and it was a very, very long article. And the one thing that struck me in this particular study was that people in other countries did not seem to have high levels of hot flashes like we see in the US studies. If we look at SWAN and some of the other big studies that we have, we usually quote that about 70 to 80% of women are going to have hot flashes. Yet in these studies, the number was a lot lower. It was, you know, like some countries 30%, 40%. And I'm thinking, well, this really doesn't make sense. So certainly, you know, diet and lifestyle is a little bit influential, but it's not as if the numbers should be that different. So then the next thing that happened was Dr. Schiff, the editor of the journal, he dropped me a note and he said, hey, I noticed that you reviewed that article and we are going to publish it, but would you like to write an editorial about it? Because it's commonly what they do. If they have a big article that's coming out, then they ask people to write their thoughts. So they didn't give me any direction at all about what to write about. They just said, just write something that has to do with this article. And, you know, I'm doing the thinking. And then I had that 2 a.m. aha moment that I thought, wait a minute, I want to write about why these numbers are so different and that I don't think it's diet and I don't think it's lifestyle. And I actually got out of bed at 2 a.m, which you're not supposed to do for good sleep hygiene, but I got out of bed and I went back and I looked at it and I looked at how they were defining menopause in that article. And basically, like they do in many studies, they were enrolling women who'd said they hadn't had a menstrual period for 12 months and therefore, by definition, were in menopause. And then I thought, okay, well, I wonder if they're including women who really aren't in menopause, women who, in spite of the fact that they're not having menstrual periods, are making estrogen. Their ovaries are not out of business. And therefore, of course, they're not going to have hot flashes because they're still making estrogen. And sure enough, that's exactly what was going on. Because when you look at populations throughout the world in developed countries, we have about 1/3 of women end up with a hysterectomy by the time they're 50 to 60. We have about 500,000 women in the United States who have endometrial ablations every year, meaning that the lining of the uterus is destroyed. So they are continuing to make estrogen, but they're no longer getting periods. And then we have a lot of people that have hormonal IUDs, a levonorgestrel IUD, which they might have for contraception or for cycle control. But the point is a lot of women who have these IUDs don't get periods. So we have huge populations of women who are not getting a period, and therefore by this old definition are in menopause, but they're not in menopause. Their ovaries are working just fine and they are producing estrogen. So I'm thinking, okay, well, the reason why the numbers were so different in this study I was asked to review is that these women were probably not all in menopause. So I wrote this editorial called "Is It Time to Rethink How Menopause is Defined?" And my approach was saying, look, the definition of menopause, the 12 months without a period, goes back to the 1800s. Well, in the 1800s, women didn't have hysterectomies. They didn't have endometrial ablations. They certainly didn't have IUDs. So then if someone went without a period for 12 months, unless they were pregnant, it was a pretty good bet that they were in menopause. But that is not the case now. And yet that definition is still the one that's being used. So I basically wrote this editorial saying this is historically what it has been. This is what we're doing now. And this is not only throwing off our research, but it's also confusing people. You know, women are told right and left, you're in menopause, you haven't had a period for 12 months. And they're thinking, well, no, I had a hysterectomy. And even that silly new test kit, you've seen the first response kit. I don't know if you listened to, I did a podcast episode on how ridiculous it is and how you test your urine for FSH.
Six times.
Yeah.
Five times.
But this is the part that I actually didn't know. Shame on me when I was taping my podcast and didn't mention it. So I'm going to mention it now. What I didn't know is that part of the algorithm is you have to have periods, because what they do is they have you log on to their app, the First Response app, and then they combine what your test result says with your menstrual history. So they tell you, if you've had a hysterectomy, if you've had an ablation, well, then you can't use our worthless kit. So I'm thinking, all right, so not only is this messing up research, but we have millions of women who are out there who are trying to figure out, am I in menopause? Am I perimenopause? What's going on? And they have this definition that just says if you've been 12 months without a period, and it's not helpful. So I wrote my editorial and I submitted it, and I was prepared. I was totally prepared to get it rejected and to get a nasty gram back saying, are you kidding? This definition of menopause has been very, very carefully thought out. There's the straw criteria. There's all these very scientific ways of looking at menopause. And all of those very scientific ways to define menopause have been spearheaded by the Menopause Society. And here I am writing an editorial for the Menopause Society, basically saying you've got it all wrong. Well, I was shocked. And I mean, shocked when, like, 2 days after I submitted my editorial, and this never happens, I got a personal note from Dr. Schiff, and it just had four words: I love your editorial. And I'm like, whoa, that's made me feel really, really good. And they basically printed it as is. I mean, they really, you know, other than some minor edits for language, they printed it as is. And yeah, so essentially what I said is this is not working for us, because not only is it confusing women in terms of figuring out, and it's confusing physicians and other clinicians in terms of how to manage women, but it's really messing up our research. So the obvious question is, okay, well, if you're doing research, why not use different criteria? And the reason is because if you look at the straw criteria, which are the scientific.
Can you explain that for people?
Yeah, so
who
what
don't
STRAW
know?
Is, and STRAW stands for Stages of Reproductive Aging Workshop. And this was a consensus opinion from the menopause folks to define, where are midlife women? What's perimenopause? What's menopause? What's postmenopause? And the original STRAW was based on menstrual history. And then they came out with STRAW plus 10. And STRAW plus 10 was supposed to address the fact that this definition is not going to be inclusive, that it can be confusing. So they talked about things like looking at different markers for, are you making estrogen, and looking at ultrasounds and all of that, which is all well and good. But from a practical point of view, if you're trying to enroll 5,000 women in a menopause study, you are not going to be sitting there and using STRAW plus 10 criteria. And it is much easier, to use the old but kind of meaningless definition of 12 months without a period. So that's how it came about. It's not that menopause folks don't realize that the 12 months without a period is problematic. They do. But from a research point of view, it's really problematic. So you say, all right, well, then what's the answer? The answer is, if you look at SWAN, and you're familiar with SWAN, I'm sure you talk about it all the time, studies women across the nation. And SWAN, of course, I think we're in the 22nd year now or something. It's been going for a long time. And it is following women that they enrolled in their 40s so that they can track everything that happens in perimenopause and postmenopause. And I think we have over 600 articles that have now come out on SWAN, which has been incredible in terms of informing what we know about perimenopause and menopause. But what SWAN does, because the SWAN people are very, very smart, is if you and we're not getting periods prior to the 12 months, then you can't be included. So the SWAN data is actually much more accurate. So the call to action, if you will, that I had in my editorial was people who are doing research should do what SWAN is doing and basically exclude women that were not menstruating prior to stopping getting their period and excluding women who've had a hysterectomy. But other people are not doing that. And in this big research study that I reviewed for the journal, they were not excluding anybody. So, you know, and right now when people have hysterectomies, for the most part, particularly if they're under the age of 55, they're keeping their ovaries. So a lot of people have that misconception. They think that hysterectomy puts someone into menopause. Hysterectomy is removal of the uterus. It does not automatically include ovaries. And if ovaries are not removed and someone's not already in menopause, a hysterectomy will not put someone in menopause. So when I give lectures, as I do a lot, and I'm talking to women, I don't use that definition for menopause. When I start my lecture and I say, okay, let's start by defining menopause. Menopause is when your ovaries are no longer producing estrogen or they've been removed. That's menopause. Period.
How do you know?
And you are in menopause until you die. You don't always know. And I actually have a podcast episode called How Do You Know You're in Menopause If You Don't Get Periods? And I really should replay it because it's kind of timely.
I'll link it.
It was during the first season. But, and essentially what I was saying is, okay, let's talk about different scenarios. So if you're getting no periods because you're on birth control pills, common scenario, right? Do we know where you are? No. Do we care? No. You're taking hormone therapy. The birth control pills are doing the talking for your ovaries and doesn't really matter. We leave you on your pill until you're 55. We take you off and chances are your ovaries are going to no longer be producing estrogen. So the second scenario is, well, what if you've had a hysterectomy? We're not going to know. Do we care? No. If you start to have symptoms, I'm going to treat your symptoms. If you don't have a uterus and you're having hot flashes and I want to give you some estrogen or, you know, fezolinetant or whatever I'm going to give you, who cares where you are? I'm just going to treat it. The one that gets a little tricky is if you're not having periods because you have a uterine ablation, where the lining of the uterus is destroyed, but it doesn't change anything hormonally. And there you do care because you have a uterus. And that means that if we are giving estrogen, we also need to give you something to protect the lining of the uterus. So that time, those are the times when, you know, sometimes a careful history, sometimes I will do some serial blood tests. There are ways to figure it out, but it's not as obvious. But my favorite is the woman who has an IUD. Because if someone has an IUD, it's a progestogen IUD, levonorgestrel IUD, and it's in her uterus and she starts to have hot flashes. And if I want to give her estrogen, I don't care where she is. I can give her estrogen because that lovely IUD is protecting the lining of her uterus and it doesn't matter. So we get so caught up and we have to label somebody. Are you perimenopause? Are you menopause? Are you postmenopause? And my approach is it doesn't really matter. We just need to know how we can safely and effectively treat whatever symptoms you might be having. Now, there's always exceptions, right? Sometimes it matters because someone might have symptoms and I'm thinking, is this menopause or is it something else? Because sometimes people will have vaginal dryness and pain or hot flashes or insomnia or a loss of libido that has nothing to do with their hormones. There's something entirely different going on. So yes, there are situations in which I do need to figure it out by doing some of the markers that they talked about in Straw 10 or doing serial blood tests. We can always figure it out. But the real question is do you need to? When does it matter and when doesn't it matter?
Yeah, thank you for that. That's Excellent. Yeah, everything you said is a bullseye. I'm curious if you do look at AMH. I mean, are you looking at some of those hormones to see where they are?
Well, you know, the interesting thing about AMH is when it first came out, anti-Müllerian hormone, a lot of people thought this is great because it was originally designed to find out if somebody was fertile. And you'd get an AMH and see if there's any chance in hell that they were going to get pregnant with their own eggs, or was it time to look for donor eggs? And then people started to say, well, gee, maybe we can use it to see if we don't need to use birth control anymore. And we have found that that's not such a good idea, because while someone's AMH might indicate that they're not fertile, it can change. It's a little more fluid than we thought. So by the same token, can we use it to see if someone is in perimenopause or menopause? And the answer is it's a piece of the puzzle, but it's not the whole answer. It really isn't. And, you know, truly the best thing we have is to get hormone levels, FSH, LH, estradiol levels, but you need to do it more than once. And, you know, to turn back to the first response kit, and I think they have either 5 tests or 6 tests that you do over the course of a couple of weeks. And I'm thinking, well, that makes more sense, no sense, because you might be fine and pumping out estrogen for a month or two, and then you stop making estrogen for a month or two, and then it clicks back in again. I mean, that's what the 12 months is about, is the idea that we understand that during perimenopause, these levels are going to bounce around, and that if you haven't had a period for a month, you certainly should not throw out your tampons or get on a plane wearing white, because you just never know, right? But once you've gone 12 months, theoretically, you're done. Now, it's always interesting to me that people think that like your uterus is like time clock in it, and they know that 12 months, and someone will call and say, it's been 13 months and I just got my period. What the hell? And it's like, yeah, okay. It's your uterus didn't know that time was up. So this is just one last hurrah, as opposed to, you know, true postmenopausal bleeding when someone is clearly done and they start to bleed. And sometimes that's tricky too. You know, is it one last hurrah, or is it that something is going on that shouldn't be? So we always check it out to make sure, because you need to know. But it can be a little confusing.
So I agree with 100% everything you just said. I think it's really important. And I know that you're going to understand this. So many women who are in my community will say, I hear you, Dr. Stryker, but my doctor says she won't treat me until I'm in menopause. Right? Like, right. And so they're just in this place, this Gordian knot that they can't get out of, you know?
Well, no, this is your point is exactly the problem, because there's this idea that if you are having hot flashes, if you are having vaginal dryness, if you are having insomnia, if you are having any of these issues, that everyone thinks that because the definition is 12 weeks, that you cannot start treatment. The definition is 12 months, you cannot start treatment for 12 months. And that is simply not true. We can start treatment whenever someone is having symptoms that are bothersome to them. The treatment that we choose is going to be informed by where they are. How I may choose to treat someone who is perimenopausal and still getting the occasional period is different than the woman who hasn't had a period in 5 years. But it doesn't mean that you can't get treated. And this really goes under this ever larger, getting larger umbrella of people who are not experts, who don't treat menopause. And the problem is that instead of referring or saying, I don't know, they just avoid. And one of the things they avoid is saying, you're not ready yet. Come back in a year and then hope that, you know, they'll go to another doctor or something. Because doctors don't like to treat menopause if they don't know what they're doing. So if someone says, I'm having all these symptoms and my doctor won't treat me, there's one of two scenarios, quite frankly. One is that your doctor's not an expert and you need to see someone else. And the other scenario is your doctor is an expert, but it's not menopause and you just think it's menopause. You know, that happens too. Someone would come to see me and say, I am gaining weight and I can't sleep and I know that it's menopause. And meanwhile, they're, you know, 42 years old, they're getting regular periods, their hormone levels are right where they should be, and there's just no indication. And you have to keep in mind other things can cause these symptoms too. So it can be tricky.
100%. And what I'm hearing you say is you really need a informed provider to walk you through this.
Right. Yeah. And I know that's not always easy to find. And
yeah.
You know, it's something that you talk about a lot. I talk about a lot. What do you do if your own clinician is clearly clueless? And that's something I've got a bunch of episodes on. And, you know, and certainly I refer people to the Menopause Society because they do keep a list. But their list, I got to say, it's no guarantee, because there are people on that list who are amazing, who are terrific, who are the rock stars in the menopause world. But there are also people on that list who are just NAMS members who are not certified menopause practitioners. And you can designate that, but people don't always know to do that. But there are also people on that list who did take the test and do, strictly speaking, qualify, but they're really not that great. And I have a lot of women who will contact me and say, okay, you said go to the list. I went to the list and it wasn't helpful. I went to see someone and they really weren't very good and I didn't like them and they wanted to put pellets in and all these things that you say are not a good idea. So it's not a guarantee, but it's certainly a good starting point. But I mean, quite honestly, the work that you do and the work that I do in terms of my books and my podcasts and all that is to give women information so that hopefully they'll find someone who can help them. But if they can't, at least they will know enough that they can, I hate to tell people to do it yourself project, but the problem of course is that if you figured out what you need and you've got these are prescription products for the most part, you know, someone's got to write the prescription. So there's that too. And so we don't have the perfect solution. Telehealth of course is post COVID, very, very big right now. And I used to be completely against telehealth. I just was. I thought, you know, I wasn't happy with what I was seeing out there. I thought women need to be examined. They need to face to face. And I have really changed my approach on that, because what I have now really appreciate is that most women don't have access. In most places that people live, they don't have an expert. If there is an expert, there's a real good chance that that person isn't taking insurance, or that there's a very, very long wait to get in with them. Yeah. And there really isn't a whole lot of options other than to go the telehealth route. And obviously there's a lot of different options out there. And some of these menopause telehealth are really just selling drugs. You know, they're kind of like online pharmacies. They're not really healthcare. I recommend MIDI, and I'm always transparent. I'm working with MIDI right now because I like what they do. And that's actually healthcare. You know, you make an appointment, it is telehealth. You are online having a virtual appointment with someone who's truly an expert. And I mean, a real expert. What they go through to train their clinicians, it's one of the reasons I connected with them. I was just overwhelmed. They have basically MIDI University and they have to pass all manner of tests. And quite frankly, they know more than you have to know to get a certified menopause practitioner. And they update it and they have meetings every week. And they're just doing an amazing job. And they take insurance in all 50 states. So they're not making money from you. It's your insurance. And if they write a prescription, you take that prescription and you take it to your pharmacy like you would if you went to a doctor. You know, they're not selling drugs. So but the point is that women do have options. I hear too often, as do you, well, I'm stuck. There's one gynecologist in my town and he or she is clueless and I don't have any way to get any help. And you can, you just have to take a few extra steps.
Yeah. I appreciate that. And I 100% know it's going to help women who are in exactly the situation that we've described. So thank you for that.
Yeah,
thanks
for we that forget because we're in big cities.
Yeah. No, it's, but I know enough people who are just like, it's a desert out there. So it's a great service. And I'll link that.
Even in the cities. I mean, I'm in Chicago and when people say to me, I need someone to go to, and the people that I know in Chicago who are great, they don't take insurance. They just don't. They spend too much time with patients. They've limited their practices. And that's the other challenge too, is that a true menopause consultation takes an hour at least. You know, when I do private, I'm actually not seeing people clinically anymore. I'm doing a lot of other things. But one of the things I do is I do private menopause master plans is what I call it, that people can connect with me for about 2 hours by Zoom and we come up with a master plan. I use every minute of that 2 hours to learn about the person, to tell them what their options are and to come up with a plan. So, you know, can be done, but yeah.
Musculoskeletal health is everything during menopause. Everyone knows how much I love Joint Health Plus from Prevenex, which has helped me get back to distance running after arthritic toes stopped me in my tracks. Now they have a product that has become my go-to for muscle strength and recovery, Muscle Health Plus. Muscle Health Plus contains all the key ingredients we talk about on this show, like creatine monohydrate, essential amino acids, and branched chain amino acids, plus even more cutting-edge ingredients like HMB and estrogen that are scientifically shown to increase muscle growth, recovery, and strength. I use it every day during my early morning lifting sessions, and there's no question that it helps my power during those workouts and my recovery after. Plus, I love having everything I need from the best high-quality ingredients in one reasonably priced shake. I've also heard from fellow users who have had bloating or GI upset in the past from creatine that haven't had any of that with Muscle Health Plus. I make my shake with almond milk and espresso, but it's also good with ice cold water, which makes the flavor really pop. As always, you can get 15% off your first order with the code HIPPLAY, all caps, one word, at Prevenex.com. That's HIPPLAY, all caps, one word, at Prevenex.com. Do your muscles a favor and head on over and get some today. For decades, running shoes have been researched, tested, and designed for men. Brands have relied on the shrink-it and pink-it approach to sell male shoes to female customers. That's why we are stoked to be working with Hedas. Hedas designs athletic footwear for women that elevates performance, safety, and style. Hedas has unlocked the science behind women's biomechanics through dedicated research and creates better shoes for women's performance. Some of Hedas' special features include a lower ankle collar to reduce rubbing on women's ankle bones, a breathable mesh toe box to allow for ventilation and accommodate female toe shape, a more narrow and reductive heel cup to reduce heel slippage and take pressure off the Achilles, a rounded instep that creates a snug fit through the middle to match the curvature of a woman's foot, and supercritical foam and a PBEX plate in the midsole to keep our legs going when the going gets tough. Hedas has three shoe models designed for different sessions: the Alma Cruise for your long runs, the Alma Tempo for training days, and the Alma Speed for pushing the pace. I've been running in the Alma Tempos, and they are a pleasure to train in. You can get your own pair of Hedas at Hedas.com and use the code FEISTY20, that's all caps, FEISTY20, for 20% off. Check it out today. We'll put a clickable link in the show notes to make it a snap. So let's shift gears a bit and while we're talking about thoughts on menopause and changing thoughts on menopause, you have a new book coming out this summer, Put the O Back in Mojo.
Put the O Back in Mojo. So this book, actually, I started to write it a couple of years ago and then put it aside because I was so busy with other projects and other things. And then I picked it up again. And basically what this book is it is a guide to midlife and postmenopause orgasm.
Okay.
So why? Why did I decide to write about this? Well, I decided this was a really important topic because, number one, at least 50% of women over the age of 50 have difficulty having an orgasm, even if they did not before. When we talk about problems with orgasm, there's two groups. There's people who've never had an orgasm, and those are very often young women, and very often this is not biologic. It's education. They need a map to their clitoris. They have trauma in the past, all kinds of legitimate reasons, but there's not anything wrong with how their clitoris is functioning, right? And then we have acquired orgasm problems. And that's what I am focusing on. I am focusing on the woman who said, boy, I used to have orgasms just fine. And now I'm 55 and either it doesn't happen or it takes so long that I can't stand it or it's so weak and unsatisfying. And so this book is to really unpack why does that happen? And then most important, and you've known me long enough to know, I'm totally solution oriented.
Right.
So I wrote this book because this book doesn't exist. Every time you look at a menopause book, and there's a lot of them out there, some good, not so good. But when they talk about sex, a lot of them will talk about vaginal dryness.
Yep.
And pain. But have you ever seen any of these books that get into an in-depth discussion about orgasm? No, they don't. And they don't go there. They don't talk about it. And women are really, truly just left in the dark. And when you say, okay, well, why is it happening? Is this because of aging? Well, aging is part of it. But we're also looking at a population of women that have medical conditions that are going to impact on the vascular supply to the clitoris. To have a healthy, responsive clitoris, you have to have good blood supply, and you have to have healthy nerve endings, period. So then you start to see women with diabetes, heart disease, multiple sclerosis, hypertension, metabolic syndrome. I mean, I think I listed over 100 conditions that can impact on the vascular health of the clitoris or on the neurologic health of the clitoris. And then suddenly they can't have an orgasm. And trust me, their endocrinologist, their cardiologist is not addressing this. No one is. So I thought, okay, this book needs to be written. So that's what I am writing now. And what I'm doing that's new for me is that because I am a gynecologist and I'm an expert when it comes to the biological, medical, and physical reasons for this, but I also acknowledge that particularly when it comes to orgasm and libido, that the psychosocial aspects are equally important, and that's not my area of expertise. But lucky for me, I have a daughter who is a sex therapist and has her PhD in clinical sexology. And that is what she does. So she is writing the sections on the psychosocial aspects of people who are not able to have an orgasm. And I'm writing the medical aspects. So between the two of us, the book is actually getting kind of long. But it's really good. It's really, really good. And it is available for pre-order. It's not coming out until late spring, but it is available for pre-order now. And the pre-orders are coming in nicely, which tells me I think I'm on to something.
I'll put a link in the show notes to that too. It's going to be a lot of notes here. I do have a, you know, that it's great that you brought that up because as you were talking, I mean, a lot of the biological reasons make complete sense, right? But like when you look at that other piece and, you know, you can talk to it as you can, when you look at how traditionally society looks at menopause as like this end of femininity and sexuality and attractiveness,
right.
We can give women all the therapies and vaginal estrogen and blood flow that they on the planet. But if she feels ashamed about being a menopausal woman, she's not going to be primed to have a great orgasm.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, it's a huge piece of it is that you have to, in your head, still feel like you are sexual. And a lot of women, of course, in this age group don't have partners. And that doesn't mean that you can't be sexual. And any single woman knows that's the case, but nobody talks about it. So I do. In this book about being sexual on your own, or if you do have a partner, and if it's a male partner, and if he has a non-functional penis, which is also very common in this age group, a lot of people think, okay, well, then, you know, game over. And in fact, that's not the case. I mean, certainly he should be getting help, but even if he doesn't, you can have amazing sex without having penetrative sex with a penis. And so, you know, certainly that is addressed as well. But the other piece of it that I cannot underemphasize is the number of women who are on antidepressants, and that's the reason why they can't have an orgasm. When the WHI came out and estrogen prescriptions plummeted, well, what went up in exact opposition was antidepressant prescriptions, which everyone things is the quick fix for whatever ails you. So right now we have something in the neighborhood of 50% of women over the age of 50 are taking an antidepressant. And certainly in most of these women, it doesn't create problems. But in a lot of women, it does. Either a problem with libido and arousal, and you have to have arousal in order to have an orgasm, or that they can't have an orgasm. And People are just kind of like disregarding that. And that's not okay. So we have this problem of a huge population of women whose sexuality has been robbed from them by an antidepressant or by being dismissed because if you have another medical problem, whether it's, you know, cancer and chemotherapy or cardiovascular disease, or, you know, there's 100 conditions I came up with, that it's like, oh, well, just be happy that you're alive. Just be happy that you're still kicking. And it's like, no, they wouldn't do that to the guys.
Yeah.
One of the things that I was just writing this chapter actually is when a guy gets diagnosed with prostate cancer and he goes in for his initial consultation with his oncologist, it is 100% of the time that that discussion is going to include, as a result of your treatment or your surgery, you may lose your ability to have an erection.
Yep.
100% of the time. Yet women, if they're diagnosed with cancer or need a hysterectomy for another reason and go in and they're told, well, part of the treatment is we're going to give you drugs to put you into menopause or we're going to remove your ovaries. And then at no point is there a discussion about, and this may kill your ability to ever have an orgasm again. It's just never said. So we have this enormous, enormous disparity, again, between male and female sexual response, which, because it's an older population, is even more so. So there's the more I write, the more I want to write. That's the problem. I mean, this book is like the never ending book. Every time I tell my daughter, oh, well, I'm, you know, this was going to be one chapter, but I divided it into three because there were so many things. I was writing the section on medical conditions that impair orgasm, and that was going to be one chapter. And I said, well, you know, cancer has to be one chapter because I've got to talk about chemotherapy and radiation and pelvic surgery and then breast cancer and rectal cancer. And so that can be a whole book right there, you know, and the whole issue with antidepressants is a whole book right there. So I'm struggling to rein it in. I got to finish this book somehow, you know.
I don't want to obviously give away the book. I am curious where you go with the antidepressant conversation, though.
Yeah, the antidepressant conversation is interesting because there has been some research done. There has been some work done. First of all, in about 30% of people, it will go away on its own, given a little bit of time. And usually if it does go away on its own, it's going to be in 6-7 months. So if it's persistent after that, then it looks like someone, it's not going to go away. The other thing also, just to be clear, is even if someone's not on antidepressants, the rates of having orgasmic difficulties just from depression is very, very high. So part of it is also figuring out, is it the drug or is it the depression? And then you've got to do a very careful history on when did it start? Did it start with the depression? Did it start with the drug? Gotcha. So that's kind of difficult too. But let's just say you're that person that you started taking your SSRI and here you are a year later and you're not able to orgasm. What are you supposed to do? Well, the options that you always hear about are, and again, these are not do-it-yourself projects. You know, you got to work with whoever prescribed it, but sometimes you can go down on the dose. Sometimes you can switch to another antidepressant. Sometimes you can actually add on something like bupropion, Wellbutrin, which will bring it back. But you know what the real fix is? The real fix is Viagra. And it's really interesting because, as you know, I ran a menopause clinic and a sexual medicine clinic for a long time. And in the clinical trials, when they looked at the use of Viagra, and I'm talking regular old the pill, the male Viagra, that when you use Viagra, the studies have been inconsistent in terms of does it help women have orgasms. But the studies were also really, really, really poorly done, and they're old, and there's not very many of them. But the one group that it does seem to work in is the antidepressant group, which is kind of interesting. So when someone would come into the sexual medicine clinic and say, I can't have an orgasm because of my SSRI, and we would, after we do our whole evaluation, and it was clear that that was the problem, we didn't mess around with anything else. We just went right to a prescription for Viagra. And I got to tell you, 90% of the time that did it. We use a small dose. It is not FDA approved for women. I want to be clear about that, which means that we don't know all the information we would like to know about safety, dosage, and all of that. But we do have a few clinical trials that show that it works. And anecdotally, it has been shown to work. In this very particular subset. Now, other subsets that we're looking at, and I just did a podcast 2 weeks ago on Viagra for women, but other subsets that we think also may be beneficial are people that blood flow to the clitoris is a real issue. Because at the end of the day, what Viagra is it's a smooth muscle relaxant that specifically relaxes the smooth muscle around blood vessels. So it's a vasodilator. So it increases blood flow. So when we look at things like people that have vascular disease, people that have diabetes, but the concern, of course, is that you don't want to give this drug, which has not been well tested, to women who have significant cardiovascular disease. Because we don't know, especially if they're using other drugs. So this is one of the problems of having a drug that's not FDA approved, is there are certain populations that we just don't know. And so you have to be careful. I don't want everyone to start like stealing their husband's Viagra because they could get into trouble. But it is interesting work. And now you're probably aware there's a topical sildenafil. Sildenafil is the chemical name for Viagra. And there's a topical sildenafil, which is now in trials in phase two. And I think they're starting to get close to phase three trials. So that would be an FDA-approved product. They're calling it an arousal cream to people who go directly on the clitoris to bypass the systemic effects. I have not seen the results of their clinical trials, but the word is that it's going well. They think that they will get FDA approval. And right now, you can get it from compounding pharmacies if you don't want to wait for that drug to come out. Actually, Midi is one of the, they have a compounding pharmacy that they work with for specialty stuff like that. And if you're a Midi patient, you can get this topical sildenafil. But it's really interesting work, and you're going to hear a lot more about it.
Wow, that is really interesting. It's funny when you were talking, I had a doctor once offer me Viagra for I was doing some racing in Colorado, like very high altitude, you know, and that it's people do sometimes use it for that. I did not take the prescription, but it was interesting. I'm like, I think I'll pass on that. But same reason, because it just it's a vasodilator.
Suppose you don't know. I'm actually surprised that there have not been more clinical trials. I don't expect the company to do them because they don't care about getting FDA approval for women. It's going to be generic anyway, and they're not incentivized to spend the millions of dollars. But just, you know, in research settings, I'm surprised that there have not been more people that have really investigated using sildenafil, oral sildenafil in women. And some people will also use, you know, Cialis is another PDE5 inhibitor, the same class of drugs, but that's the one that you take it every day so that you're always good to go. And certainly I know many, many menopause experts, myself included, who prescribe that for their patients who know that they're not going to have an orgasm without using that. And so when we say solutions for us, I mean, those aren't the only solutions. There's others too. I mean, that's why my book is getting so long, because I just keep, you know, thinking of more solutions and more things, but there are things that people can do. One thing I don't tell people is give up. But they also have to kind of figure out how important is it to have an orgasm. You can have great sex without an orgasm and satisfying sex, but we live in this society where there's this expectation of the grand finale, otherwise it doesn't count. And that's not true. Like, otherwise, how do you know when you're done, right? That's what my daughter's always talking about. This is the problem, is that people feel like there needs to be some event to know that they're done having sex. And we got into this whole discussion. My daughter, her name is Rachel Zarr, and we did a podcast on faking orgasm from the, you know, point of view of her point of view and my point of view. And that was actually great fun. It's always nice having these mother-daughter chats about things like faking orgasm. But that was the point that she kept making, is that, you know, people also just, you have to have another way of saying, I'm done. You know, that was really nice, and now let's go to sleep.
That's so true. Speaking, just continuing this conversation in another lane, I saw that you recently authored a published study for the Kinsey Institute in partnership with Cosmopolitan on the topic of sex after 60. How did that partnership come about?
Well, I've been working with the Kinsey Institute for some time, and I'm a senior research fellow with Kinsey and have been doing other research projects with them. So the head of this particular project, she had been contacted by Cosmo to say, we would like to do an article on sex after 60, and we want to do a huge survey to see what the attitudes are, what people are doing, and what they're experiencing. And we would like the Kinsey Institute to partner with us. So they said, great, this sounds terrific. So they put together a team, and I was part of that team, that we came up with the questions that were going to be used on the survey. I did all the orgasm questions. Thank you very much. It was great fun coming up with those. And so there were over 3,000 women in that survey. And the deal with Cosmo is they wanted to have first crack at talking about it. And they wrote a very nice article, which, by the way, if you read the article, and we'll put the link and you can get it online. But there's two people that are primarily interviewed in that article, me and Rachel Zarr. Rachel Zarr is my daughter, the
I
sex
didn't know
therapist.
that when I read it.
Neither did they. They interviewed both of us, not knowing we were mother and daughter.
That's great.
And Rachel calls me up and says, oh, by the way, I was just interviewed for this interesting study that Cosmo did with the Kinsey Institute. Do you know about it? And I said, do I know about it? I'm part of it. And they just interviewed me too. So this article comes out, and it's full of her quotes, more than mine, by the way, and then full of my quotes. So, but that's how it came about. But the important thing is that we have a lot more data than was included in Cosmo. That was just, you know, a few snippets, if you will. It's a good article. It's worth reading. But that was just a little bit. We have lots more data, and then we are now in the process of writing it up to submit to academic journals, because the kinds of questions that we asked were not the standard things that are asked. You know, when you look at validated questionnaires, like I know you've talked about the FSFI and the other scientific questionnaires that we use, but that doesn't include a lot of things we really want to know. Like, if you can't have an orgasm, how about if you use a vibrator? And, you know, how often are you having unpartnered sex versus partnered sex? And, you know, on and on and on. So there are a lot of questions on there that are not part of the usual validated scientific questionnaires that I think are, quite frankly, more meaningful and more informative. So stay tuned on that, because those articles are going to start coming out in the publications.
Well, if you had to sort of, you know, condense what you learned from that, like what are the take homes, and was there anything that surprised you?
The take homes from the article were, number one, women over 60 are having sex, they like sex, they want to continue to have sex, and most of them have figured out how to have satisfying sex. But satisfying sex is defined in many, many ways that very often has nothing to do with intercourse, that has nothing to do with a partner, and very often has everything to do with being self-sexual, with or without a partner, with using a vibrator, and with really kind of thinking out of the box. Did any of it surprise me? Not really, because my perspective is a little different, because not only am I very familiar with the literature out there, but I see thousands of patients a year in sex clinic and menopause clinic. So if you ask the right questions, people will tell you. And if you ask someone, are you having orgasms? How are you having those orgasms? Are you able to have an orgasm when you use your vibrator? You get a really pretty good picture of what's going on out there, far more than most doctors do, because they're not asking the right questions. So there was nothing about it that really surprised me. But what was important is that I think this will surprise most women and will be informative to them, that I'm not a freak of nature because I still want to have orgasms and I'm 70. I'm not like hypersexual or things that people get accused of, and that it is normal to continue to be sexual throughout your life. Biologically, it's not. Biologically, we're on Earth to have one reason, and that's to reproduce. And once you can no longer reproduce, there's no point in being sexual. But women live long after their reproductive years, and it's never been questioned for the guys about them maintaining their sexuality throughout their life. So this is just a nice public display of, yeah, it's important for the women too.
This may be an obvious question, but what do we as a culture get wrong about our perceptions and general understanding of women in postmenopausal sex?
Everything. Next question.
That's fair.
Everything. I mean, there's this idea that, first of all, women postmenopausal, it's not even part of the conversation. People don't think of them as being sexual. And certainly one of the problems is it's an ageism thing. It's a sexist thing. But also when you look at older adults, and particularly older women who do have other medical problems. I mean, let's face it, over the age of 50, 50% of women have at least one medical problem. By 60, it's usually two or three. So when you have someone that has cardiovascular disease, diabetes, whatever, the idea is, well, they're not being sexual. They're just taking care of their medical problems. And we know that's not the case. And the other thing also we have to keep in mind is that when we think of menopause, typically, we are thinking about women in their 50s, 60s, 70s and on. But there are many, many women in this country who are very young, either because of a premature ovarian insufficiency or failure, or who have cancer, or who've had a hysterectomy because of endometriosis. So yes, for women who are in their 20s and 30s and 40s and who are postmenopause, this is huge. The idea is saying, no, your sex life isn't over, and there are things we can do. And you know what? The proof is going to be, quite frankly, Celine, and who buys my book. I mean, there's really nothing out there, because every book out there that talks about sexuality is about psychosocial. you know, see a therapist, talk about the relationship. Well, you can talk till the cows come home, but if your vagina is like the Sahara Desert, it's not going to get you anywhere. So we'll see if people are interested in learning about what they can do to make sure that they're lubricated and that their clitoris is responsive.
Excellent. Well, I have thoroughly.
Guess me a year from now how this book sells.
I will promote it. We'll see. I have thoroughly enjoyed this conversation, as I knew I would. Is there anything that we have not talked about that you wanted to make sure that you express?
Now, there's a loaded question. as we know from past experience, you and I could talk for hours. Yeah. I think we've covered a lot with this, and I hope given women some hope about their sexuality and about how things are going to get better in terms of getting good information and good solutions out there. So I thank you. I thank you as always for having this conversation with me.
If a woman, and I'll sneak one in under the wire, because I hear this a lot and I'm curious in your take on it. If somebody says, you know, I don't have sex and I'm not interested in sex and it doesn't blah, blah, blah. Do you let that go or do you,
you dig
a little bit more?
No. Well, so this is the thing. Sometimes someone will say, I'm really not interested in sex. Because the question that I very often will ask, I don't say, are you sexually active? Because that's meaningless. I'll say, are you satisfied with your current sex life, with your current level of sexuality? And if someone says, yeah, I'm fine, then my response to that is, okay, that may change. And if at any point you do care, if things change, know that there are a lot of things we can do that are going to help reignite that feeling and your ability to have sex. This can happen. This can change at any time in your life. But, you know, there's really three groups. There's people who are having difficulty and they're very upset. The medical word is distressed. I don't like that word. But, you know, they're frustrated. They're upset. They want to get their sex life back. So that's group one. Group two are women that really don't care that much, but their partner does. You know, whether it's a man or a woman, that their partner is saying, sex is important to me. I wish it was more important to you. And because they love their partner and they want to keep that relationship, it becomes important to them. And right. Then there's group three, the group that you mentioned that just says, you know what? I'm fine. I don't need to be sexual right now. I have a full life. I don't have any desire. I am not missing it. And my response is, great. But if that changes, we'll talk.
Perfect. I love it. Well, thank you as always. I will put a million links in the show notes so people can find all your work and your book and look forward to talking to you again.
Thank you.
Well, that's our show. Come on back next week when I sit down with Dr. Ashley Austin, a primary medicine sports doc at the Hospital for Special Surgery in New York. We talk all about arthritis, which is one that's been requested a bunch of times. So come on back. We dig in next week. And until then, as always, stay feisty. You've been listening to Hit Play, Not Pause, a feisty menopause podcast for active, performance-minded women. I'm your host, Celine Yeager. The show is edited and produced by the strong, talented, and amazing women at Live Feisty Media. Follow us on social media at Feisty Menopause. And please help us spread the word. Screenshot and share this episode on your social media channels with the tag @FeistyMenopause. Share the show with your friends. And please subscribe, like, review, and rate this show wherever you get your podcasts. Word of mouth and good reviews make it easier for other listeners to find. Thanks for listening, and as always, stay feisty.